you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
What's up, everybody? This is Julian Geiser from Great Heart Consulting. My pronouns are he, him, and you're listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. The goal of each episode is to give people the tools and resources they need to create inclusive environments that truly reflect the diversity of our modern workforce. I sit down with various agents of change to discuss the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies that need to be implemented to bring change effectively. The diversity, equity, inclusion field has been getting a ton of attention in the last decade, but it's been around for much longer than that. The passing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and related legislation created a need for organizations to attend to and address workplace diversity training. From what I've been told, since I wasn't there for it, through the 70s, 80s, and even well into the 90s, much of D&I work focused on compliance with employment legislation and achieving representational diversity. Since the early 2000s, there's been a slow shift towards a greater focus on inclusion and now belonging. Especially in the past decade, we've seen DEI work take a marked shift towards addressing inequity in a far more systemic way and behavioral way, with a goal of creating organizations that are truly in service of their employees and customers, and not just their shareholders. Joining me to further explore the evolution of DE&I in the public and corporate spheres is Bill Hawthorne, the former Senior Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer for Macy's Incorporated, the former Chief Equity Officer for the City of Atlanta in the Cabinet of the Mayor, and the co-founder and Chief Strategy Officer of Inclusent, a DE&I consulting firm. Before kicking ass in the DE&I sector, Bill began his career as a prosecutor in the offices of the city solicitor and as Fulton County District Attorney in Atlanta. He's a Morehouse man and holds a law degree from Emory University School of Law. Welcome, Bill, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, good afternoon or good day, Julian. Thank you so much for that copious introduction. It is my absolute pleasure to be here with you today.
Thanks, Bill. And as we start all these episodes, I'd love to have you introduce yourself to our listeners by talking about a few aspects of your identity that are especially important to you.
Sure, Julian. I think you pretty much covered the main points in your very generous introduction, but I will add my pronouns are he, him. I am a husband, a father, recently became the grandfather of 20-month-old twin boys.
Oh, nice.
That have been just a huge joy, and officially became a South Floridian. I've spent a good amount of time over the past decade living in New York and Atlanta, but officially claimed South Florida as the place where I'm going to be casting my vote. So I voted for the first time as a Floridian in the primaries in the state this past Tuesday. So
awesome.
Pretty excited about that. That's a very new thing for me.
Well, we'll have to, I did not realize that you had twins in the family, young twins in the family. I've got twins of my own. So maybe we'll have to stay on after we conclude the recording here and chat a little bit about that. Love to hear about your own experience with that. So Bill, first question we've got for you today is, when you became a senior VP and the chief diversity officer at Macy's in 2006, yeah, I imagine that you didn't have too many peers in that CDO role. So what was the catalyst for creating that role way back in 2006? And how did you come to hold that position?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Julian, I will make a very long story bearable in the interest of time. It does seem like it was eons ago, but in answer to your question, as you mentioned, I am a lawyer by training, and in 2006 or, you know, thereabouts, I'm happily serving the company as a VP corporate attorney, nicely progressing along the legal career track, you know, one day thinking I might be a judge or a general counsel and either at Macy's or some other corporation. But the company had just recently acquired then its largest competitor, the May Company, and literally doubled in size, both in terms of revenue and headcount, going from a $15 billion organization to a $30 billion organization, and jumping from a 100,000 headcount employee to a 200,000 employee headcount organization. And the leadership at the time felt like it needed to really take some steps to determine how best to position the Macy's brand for future success. And to help it clarify its thinking in that regard, hired McKinsey Company to come in and do some analysis and to give us some thoughts and recommendations on how best to position the brand. Among other great and strong recommendations McKinsey had was that very strongly urged the organization to leverage diversity as a strategic advantage, since the footprint of the company was virtually in every top diverse market in the United States, and those include some of the obvious ones in New York City, Chicago, South Florida, Houston, Atlanta, SoCal, Bay Area, you know, just to name a few. The company agreed with that recommendation and asked me then to pivot from a VP of legal to a newly created CDO officer level position that would oversee the creation of a DEI strategy that would focus on the workplace, our supplier relationships, our MarCom strategies, and community partnerships. So after, you know, giving that request lots of serious consideration, Julie and I decided to take on the new challenge. Never look back. It turned out to be one of the best career decisions I've ever made. As they say, if you're doing something that you're very passionate about and enjoy doing, you'll never work another day in your life. So that's how I felt and feel today about that career transition.
That's incredible. And one of the things that I was thinking about is, you know, you talked about that transition from your role in a more legal capacity to the role of CDO was one of the things one of the key motivators often for companies seem to get into the game with DE&I work is the risk, especially today, the risk that exists in not getting into it. And so I wonder what I appreciated about what you said there was that, you know, Macy's had gone out, found McKinsey, and McKinsey had recommended that they look at diversity as a strategic advantage. How did risk factor? Was there like a risk consideration? And do you think, how did that factor into their ask of you as a lawyer to maybe to make that transition from having been in a more legal counsel role to being the CDO for such a newly large organization?
Yeah, no, so that's another excellent question, very insightful question. And I have to say, though I would like to say that the company's motivation was solely focused upon kind of the upside, sales enhancement and brand reputation. Candidly, there was a component of risk management baked into the thinking of our senior management. If you think about corporate America in the mid late 90s, and I was really in the throes of this as part of my portfolio of responsibility as a lawyer was to oversee our mega case litigation for the company. And part of doing that, Julian, would entail my looking at a number of high profile lawsuits, including class action lawsuits. Mm-hmm. To dissect those lawsuits, understand kind of where those organizations went wrong, and then to take a proactive and preventative steps for Macy's so that we didn't end up in the bullseye of some class action plaintiff's lawyer. One case that was very high profile at the time was the Coca-Cola class action lawsuit. It was a race-based class action lawsuit that was filed in the mid-90s, I believe, late 90s. And as we thought about and looked at the tea leaves, and we saw that one big brand after another was finding itself as a target of major race-based class action lawsuits or gender discrimination lawsuits. We saw a number of gender-based discrimination lawsuits crop up in the finance industry at that time. So while there was certainly some proactive and sales and reputation enhancement benefits associated with the decision to create this new function within the company, Concurrent with that consideration was also the idea of reducing risk for the company so that it wouldn't find itself being targeted by a major class action lawsuit.
Yeah, and we it seems like we keep seeing variations on that theme as we progress. It seems like there's, you know, just about every year there's something pretty significant happening. Well, good. Well, as we've established, you're a lawyer by trade. I think one of the things that's really interesting is that you've served in both corporate and government settings. And so I've got to ask you, how do you think about the evolution of the DE&I work over these last few decades?
Well, I tell you, and you mentioned early on, Julian, that when I first went into the role, I did not have many corporate peers. I probably could count them on one hand. Frankly, I'm not exaggerating. As I think back, you know, Verizon had a CDO. In fact, the CDO who was still in place at Verizon was kind enough to let me come over to her New York office and kind of share with me kind of a bit of her thinking and how best to position this function within a large organization. Coca-Cola, as I mentioned, had just come out of a very high-profile, difficult lawsuit. They, because of that lawsuit and the settlement, had just created a function called a chief diversity officer function. So I spent time with the new CDO there. But aside from those two brands, Julian, I frankly am searching my memory to think about a senior level position that was actually called a chief diversity officer that existed at the time. So
wow.
I would say we were, and I was, and my handful of peers were really starting down this new trail in, very small company. So I've seen a remarkable amount of evolution in this space since, since 2000 to 2010. And the way I'll talk about it is just to look at what I saw from 2000 to 2010, kind of high level, 2010 to 2020, and then, you know, what we are seeing here firsthand and, 2020 and beyond. So 2000, of course, and you mentioned this, the Civil Rights Act had been passed in 64. And so, we went from like affirmative action, which, as you know, was sort of a mindset put into place to reverse decades of illegal workplace exclusion for many, for women and minority groups. So '90s was a time where the term diversity was sort of invented. It was often confused with the term affirmative action, which, as you know, was an unfavorable term for many folks within large organizations, because there was a feeling that it gave an unfair advantage to certain folks. And so you saw progress being moving really at a glacial speed. And you talked about risk management. I would say for the most part, companies at that time, with the exception of an enlightened few, were really motivated to really focus on diversity as a way to reduce risk. I saw an article not long ago, and it talked about diversity being a, quote, often neglected HR niche during this time frame. And that, you know, that's a characterization I would agree with. And so from year 2000 to 2010, progress very, very slow. Now jumping into 2010, you know, what we begin to see in 2010 to 2020, really thanks to organizations like McKinsey. I'm a big fan of McKinsey. They've been talking about DEI and the benefits of DEI for many, many years. As I mentioned, that was really a catalyst for Macy's taking direction from them and positioning DEI as a strategic priority, in the mid 2000s. Other big brands that were demonstrated real leadership to this topic were Procter & Gamble, PwC, Black Enterprise. And what they were successful doing, Julian, is clearly demonstrating and visibly championing the tangible benefits of DEI and making the case through data and analytics that brands that did well on DEI outperformed their peers, did better on the stock market, and just generally improved their brand image and reputation in the marketplace by focusing on DEI as a strategic priority. And they began also to talk about the moral case for DEI. In other words, it was not only good for business, but it was also the right thing to do for corporations. Although, you know, there were many detractors about DEI within large organizations. So for the most part, between 2010 and 2020, it was really incumbent upon leaders who were inside organizations to come up with a compelling business case, clearly connecting the investment in DEI and investing in the resources into DEI with some kind of, you know, tangible monetary return on investment. And now the jump to 2020, you know, and I say, and I talk about 2020 because I think we saw really a sea change in year 2020. And, you know, needless to say, the catalyst for that sea change was the murder, the senseless murder of George Floyd in May 2020. And I think what that did is it resulted in a real reckoning on the part of organizational leaders to understand that not only was it important to have a business case for DEI, but as organizational leaders. And when I say organizational leaders, I'm talking about corporate leaders. I'm talking about nonprofit leaders. I'm talking about elected officials and other political organizations. Really did, I think, for the first time, based upon what I've observed over the past, 20 years or so, accepted the obligation to make sure, as organizations with immense influence and resources, that they were arguing for and demonstrating that diversity should be front and center on any organizational initiatives chart. So that's what I saw play out from 2010 to the present. I think, you know, today we're seeing some just remarkable steps being taken in this area.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things I think I kind of heard you alluding to there for organizational leaders, whether they're in public, private, nonprofit sectors, is this idea that, you know, we always, so I spent some time in the Navy, and I think there one of the things that was really, imposed upon me was this idea that there's a critical responsibility for a leader to be responsible for the culture they create. So, and I'll give you like a great example of that was that in the Navy, the captain of a particular ship, when she or he arrived to that ship, they are announced as the name of the ship arriving. So, for me, my first ship was the USS Ford. They'd be announced as Ford arriving. And I always found that to be really a really powerful embodiment of the responsibility that leaders have for the culture. And I think that we connect that to the behaviors of those leaders. And so I think the progression that you talked about, I also see like a connected and parallel progression of, okay, we're the executives of this organization. We are going to fund a new role, let's say using Mace as an example, we'll fund a new role for Bill as the chief diversity officer. Bill will have a strategy. He'll communicate that strategy to us. We'll help execute it. And I think now in 2020, what it seems like is happening more and more is that the entire C-suite is taking greater responsibility for that strategy, for their own behaviors, for the ways in which the work of DE&I within our own teams can be a catalyst to fuel innovation and productivity, belonging, engagement, and ultimately drive revenue and growth. So I love the progression that you shared with us. And I think as someone who was, to your recollection, was one of three, which when you said on one hand, I was excited to hear you kind of share. We'll see how many you could get to. And the fact that you got the three, I think says something important about you know, how that you were really on the vanguard of a really important change in the early 2000s.
Yeah, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that while myself and a handful of colleagues were on the vanguard, we did, because it was brand new track for us, we did look outside of our respective organizations to, you know, identify partners who also were like-minded and thinking about DEI in the most strategic way. And that's actually how I met your CEO, Chuck Shelton, who was right there, you know, with us. And in fact, I think as I shared, as we were kapitzing before the beginning of this broadcast, I met Chuck at Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the three CDOs that I mentioned, and Chuck was there giving a very impactful presentation on the importance of DEI and the workplace. And so while we were certainly there, you know, leading the charge within our respective organizations, it was very important for us to look outside of our organizations for external expertise. And I'm happy that that we were able to connect with your CEO, Chuck Shelton, at the time.
Right. Yeah. Chuck's kind of one of those OGs as well.
I'll say.
So as we talked a little bit about the history and what you see happening in the space that gets you excited today, how do you, you know, how about when you think about the future of DE&I work, what do you see down the pipe that gets you excited?
Well, you know, as I said previously, for me, and that's one of the reasons I was selected to serve in the role of Chief Diversity Officer back in 2006. Or eight, whenever it was, because it demonstrated a real passion for the subject. So somebody who is really passionate about the impact, the positive impact that DEI can play in our individual lives, in our work lives, and really in our community, I see a lot of reasons for us to be excited about the future progress of DEI in those areas, home, workplace, and in the community. The most important thing I'm seeing, though, is because there's always been a lot of talk about DEI. You know, they call it lip service, or you know, you can pick the unflattering term that is used to describe lots of talk but no action. But right now, I see, to my great satisfaction, the needle is demonstratively moving in measurable ways from, you know, diverse, the highest representation ever on boards, the executive level and C-suites, the hiring of CDOs. I think it was LinkedIn that reported last year that the CDO role was, you know, trending at a 300 or 400% increase to the previous year. That was 2021, so it was looking, I think, at data in 2019 and 2020. So you're seeing more than ever. In fact, just this morning, someone sent me an advertisement about a major retailer that was seeking a CDO role, one that you would not think would be interested in, you know, putting a CDO in the executive suite. But we're seeing that trend continue. We're seeing, you mentioned. You know, even the armed services, we're continuing to see Black and Latino officers break the glass ceiling there to be, you know, 4-star generals. That's never happened before.
Right.
We're seeing unprecedented spending now with minority and women-owned businesses. We're seeing corporations with the wherewithal recognizing the importance of historically Black colleges and universities, and therefore they're investing money, you know, with those institutions and also hiring its graduates. And we're seeing a number of nonprofit organizations that have lots of clout and big bank accounts really focused on racial equity, playing leading roles in their respective communities to bring attention and focus to the need for everyone to align to create opportunities for racial equity in and around the United States. So I'm seeing lots of reasons to be excited and ways in which the needle is moving in really measurable and unparalleled ways.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think there's a lot of exciting things happening right now. I think that statistic around the number of CDOs that are being hired. And one of the things that I was curious about, you talked about going to New York and meeting with the CDO of Verizon when you'd been newly placed into that role at Macy's. And I was curious, one of the things that I think is also changing is that if those roles are being created anew, that role is being directly placed into an executive capacity. So right alongside the CMO, the CRO, the CTO, as opposed to historically what I think has happened is that, and this is telling of the ways in which diversity has been thought of, it's been placed within the HR function often or within the HR talent organization. And so I'm just curious, is that a shift that you're seeing more and more as companies create or restructure? Are they moving? Are they placing that CDO in, alongside some of those more traditional C-suite executive roles?
I appreciate that question. In fact, seeing the increase in the number of diversity head roles that were being created, again, post George Floyd, I talk about DEI progress now in terms of pre-George Floyd, post-George Floyd. And where we saw the rapid increase in the hiring was post-George Floyd, obviously, when there was this organizational reckoning about, the need to really make some big gains in the area of DEI. But, what I saw is that organizations were not carefully recruiting and placing those executives in positions or in the organizational structure where they were set up to win. Mm-hmm. That recognition caused me actually to hold a webinar in January of 2021, Julian, where the topic of our webinar was playing to win or set up for success, and I invited a couple of CDOs, one from Verizon. As I mentioned, she was the person who took me under her wing, Magda, and another from Delta, Kira, both who had been in their positions for 10 years or longer. And so I wanted them to share, with our listening audience. And it was, we had 125 listeners in. For that webinar, I wanted them to share kind of their secrets to success and what it really takes. And they talked about where the function should be positioned, what it really takes to be strategic, what it really takes to lead by influence when you don't have necessarily direct reports whose performance reviews you sign off on. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the real skill set and the leadership traits that were necessary in order to be an effective CDO within a large organization. So getting back to your specific question, I would say it's probably half and half. Half of the organizations are really and thoughtfully recruiting either internally or externally for this position, and others are not. Mm-hmm. Others are taking more of a check the box kind of approach to filling this kind of DEI role. And with respect to the latter practice, what we're seeing now already in 2022 is those positions turning over already in a short span of 2 years, because those executives were miscast to begin with for lots of different reasons. A nonprofit executive who may have been very passionate about DEI and racial equity or gender equity perhaps is not the right person to come inside of a large organization to lead without sector or organizational knowledge to lead in an area where it's so necessary to gain cross functional support in leadership, you know, on these subjects in order to really, really make progress. So I think the answer to the question is probably half and half. And, you know, we actually have we offer our consultancy, we offer a session, kind of a one-on-one session with newly appointed CDOs called Being Set Up to Win, for that very reason, to help those CDOs understand the ropes, you know, really what it takes to, you know, to get stakeholder support and engagement in leading this initiative across multiple functions.
I appreciate that answer. And I think we'll have to connect with you and get that webinar link and share that with our listeners as well, because this feels like something critical that we often come across is either CDOs are inappropriately positioned within the organization. And when they are, one of the dangers is that they continue to be viewed as one, they may be tokenized, hopefully not, but often that happens. Or two, they're just viewed as like a subject matter expert, you know, where people are like, oh, well, we've got this CDO. I can go ask all my silly race-based questions to them, instead of really being seen as a center of excellence that can drive competitiveness and improve retention numbers, recruitment numbers, and ultimately improve the profitability and success of the organization. So we'll have to share that. As you look out at the landscape, we've talked a lot about this a little bit. Are there any specific things you've seen an organization do recently that you feel is innovative and catalyzing inclusion in a really powerful way?
Well, yes. The answer is yes, yes, and
okay,
yes.
Good. I'm glad it's not no.
Yeah, it's you know, again, we're in new territory here, which I think is so exciting where DEI is concerned. You know, we're seeing as I mentioned, every Fortune 100 organization now has a public stated initiative supporting DEI. I think the number is 40% of that number, if not a greater number. The precise percentage is escaping me now, actually tie DEI progress to compensation. That is a very new step that organizations are taking to signal the importance that they are placing upon DEI progress. And the other thing that's remarkable, and again, this is post George Floyd, is we're seeing stakeholders having a greater voice in holding brands accountable to DEI progress. And the two stakeholders, namely, that I'm referring to are employees of organizations and also customers of organizations. We have seen this dynamic play out several times with large household brands, Amazon, Google, a host of other corporations who have had to pause, listen to their employees who demanded greater DEI progress, listen to their customers who are demanding greater DEI progress, and to make organizational change based upon what they're hearing from those two critical stakeholders, without which they could not continue to be profitable organizations. We saw this dynamic play out most recently and publicly with Disney of late, regarding Disney's hesitance to take a public stand on the controversial Don't Say Gay law in Florida. If you remember how that situation was developing, the Disney CEO felt like he did not want to wade into those controversial waters and therefore was silent on the subject. That was until Disney employees spoke up. They held a walkout. Customers were demanding that Disney take a public stand against the law, and notwithstanding that Disney was, you know, really catching it from all sides. You know, the governor was was daring Disney to take a position opposite the law, and the stakeholders I just mentioned were saying to Disney, "You must take a position condemning that law." And we know what happened in the final analysis is Disney decided, despite the risks of the wrath that it might face from the governor, and actually did face, that it was going to align with the point of view of its employees and customers to take a public stand against that law on the basis of that law conflicting with the organizational values of inclusion. And that's another important thing that we're seeing, Julian, is that organizations now are behaving and acting in a way that is in keeping with their organizational values, as opposed to some law or some policy. They're saying, you know, one of our key values is inclusion. If there is an employee action or a stakeholder action or a law that is inconsistent with our organizational values, mm-hmm. we are going to voice that point of view publicly, regardless of the consequences they may face by those who would disagree with that position.
I think that greater integrity and consistency that organizations are demonstrating, I think is really key. And you also talked about the power of organizations listening. I don't think that's always something that organizations or, you know, executives have been particularly good at. And so I think it seems like there's one of the things to get excited about is that we are listening better. Organizations and individuals within those organizations are doing a far better job of listening and listening with greater degrees of humility than ever before. And so hopefully that's something that we'll continue to see the evolution of in organizational life and in the business world as well. So Bill, I really appreciate you joining us today. And as we close this episode of Inclusion Catalyst, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you to tell our listeners where they can find you.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for that closing question. And it's easy. I am the Chief Strategy Officer for Inclusit. We're an organization that partners with C-suite executives who are committed to achieving optimal success in the workplace and marketplace through DEI. I can personally be reached at bill.hawthorne@inclusit.com or LinkedIn at Bill Hawthorne. And our website is www.inclusit.com.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks again to Bill Hawthorne for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion. And thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. Do you know anyone that needs to hear this message? If so, be sure to click that share button. You can connect with me, Julian Geiser, and Great Heart Consulting on LinkedIn. As always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.